atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay. How are you doing this morning?
Sympathetic, elderly, and forgetful, I'm afraid, but we'll muddle through.
Yes, I assume we will. Before we do muddle through with all of the stuff we are going to get to, and that, of course, means the Biden special counsel report and a number of Trump stories, and, well, we've just got a bunch of things going on. I want to start first by thanking our newest supporter, Wade. Wade, thank you so much for supporting us on Patreon. We really appreciate it. And also one other thing that's sort of near and dear to the hearts of both Jay and myself. This week, we were sad to learn of the passing of Mojo Nixon. Now, you might not have heard of Mojo, and that's your loss, because he was a fun guy. He, at one point, he called his music like The Clash, but even faster and stupider. And I think it's a pretty good... his biggest hits, Elvis Is Everywhere, which if you haven't listened to that, you really need to do that. Also, Don Henley Must Die. Debbie Gibson Is Pregnant With My Two-Headed Love Child. Great stuff. And if you want political music, he's got I Hate Banks, I Ain't Gonna Piss In No Jar, and Legalize It. A fun guy. And with his passing, the world is a slightly less fun place. So Mojo.
Elvis is Everywhere was sort of like our theme song,
yeah,
for like a good couple solid months in 1990, 1991, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mojo will be missed, certainly by us. And
he has gone to meet Elvis.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's move on then. On Thursday, special counsel Robert Hur released his report on President Biden's handling of classified documents, concluding that while Biden willfully retained and disclosed classified materials, no criminal charges are warranted, which on the surface seems like a positive outcome, except it's most definitely not, because one of the key factors Hur cited for not bringing charges is Biden's failing memory. And in the report, he writes, Mr. Biden's memory was significantly limited, both during his recorded interviews with the ghostwriter in 2017, that's for his memoir, Promise Me Dad, and in his interview with our office in 2023. Hur characterized Biden, now famously or infamously, as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, and concludes, it would be difficult to convince a jury that they should convict him, by then a former president well into his 80s, of a serious felony that requires a mental state of willfulness. Now, President Biden responded quickly and angrily, denying that he willfully retained any classified documents, and insisted, my memory is fine, though when answering questions from the media, he did refer to the leader of Egypt as the leader of President
Mexico.
Of Mexico. Yeah. And this follows, of course, a similar moment earlier in the week when Biden referred to meeting with François Mitterrand of France and Helmut Kohl of Germany, both of who have been deceased for a while. And when Biden was asked why he shouldn't step aside and let someone else be the Democratic nominee, which he seemed to all but promise he would do when he was running in 2020, he replied, because I'm the most qualified person in this country to be president of the United States and finish the job I started. So, Jay, what's your take on all of this news?
That's the line I should have led with. I'm the most qualified person in the country. But look, on the one hand, I think it's not unexpected that the special counsel decided not to prosecute. And we can talk about that in a minute. The reasoning is also, I guess, not surprising, right? The reaction from the left is a little surprising. But yeah, I think it sort of played out sort of how I would have expected it to. Although I'm surprised that there was this much about the memory issue, that's my quick take on what is a several hundred page report, and truth be told, I have not read the whole thing yet. I've read the snippets, I've read the executive summary, but the picture it paints of President Biden is not a good one either from the perspective of what he did with these documents. In some cases, documents which he took when he was a senator out of apparently a SCIF secure facility where you're not supposed to take things out of, sharing documents with the ghostwriter. And so I think there was, it was not a good look for him on the liability piece of it. And I think even a worse look on the memory or competency issue. And then there was, again, they launched immediately into the, what I would call sort of the weird primetime infomercial for the 25th Amendment. You know, again, it was sort of weird, Mike, cause I was home, I'm watching TV and they're like, the president to address the nation. You're like, what? And yeah, it just got weirder from there. So that's my quick initial take, but we can dive deeper into each of those issues.
Yeah.
You know, going forward here.
I want to talk about the 25th Amendment thing for folks who don't know. That's the one that covers what happens if a president is incapacitated in some way or unable to fulfill his duties. And there have been some on the right who said, well, if Biden is not being prosecuted because he lacks that that willfulness, right, to be able to understand what he did or remember what he did, therefore the 25th Amendment should be invoked. Now, I want to point out what I think is probably an important legal distinction, and I think erred in describing what was in the summary of the report, so I want to backtrack. I said that Herr concluded that Biden willfully retained and disclosed materials. Actually, and I think, Jay, you might appreciate this distinction, the actual words were, our investigation uncovered evidence that he did this. And to me,
that's
an important distinction, because you can uncover evidence of a lot of things without those things actually being necessarily so, or being necessarily so to the point where it would make sense to bring charges, right?
Yeah. And also, I mean, keep in mind, the special prosecutor's job at this point, at any point, right, is largely fact-finding. And, you know, they go out, find the facts. They're not there to make the legal conclusion, right? They are there to say there is either enough evidence to move forward or there is not enough evidence to move forward, right? So I think that is an important distinction.
Yeah. And he said, in fact, even if there weren't this Justice Department policy against bringing charges, I still would not recommend that, right? Because the argument is that it could not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, of course, one of those reasons is citing Biden's memory lapses. And I guess I'm of two minds of this, Jay. In one sense, I understand the argument. And I think if you're going to lay out the reasons why you think charges should not be brought, well, if that's part of it, you have to explain it. But I also think that parts of the report were written in such a way that could have been written in a way that was more neutral and less prejudicial, right, than well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. I mean, for instance, I think that
that's pretty nice.
Well,
that's a nice thing to say.
Except it's not, and it's not.
You know, it wasn't babbling idiot.
Well, it's not, and you know it's not, right? I mean, you're joking, but he could have done this with a more neutral formulation, something about multiple memory lapses during the interview and the ghostwriter session led this office to conclude that there's reasonable doubt, blah, 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 without the sort of tailor-made for, you know, these sort of memes or things like that. And I think that's a failure on, it's weird for me to argue that that an attorney should write more like an attorney, but this is what I'm going to argue at this point here, is I think he was a little too colorful. And in that sense, I believe that he went beyond what he should have done. And he basically, I feel like he strayed into, whether knowingly or not, into using partisan favoring language to describe something that he could have and should have described more neutrally.
Maybe. I would look at it the other way in that here. I mean, maybe I'm not this big a look at it the other way, but this would be my response, is understanding if I'm the special counsel and I'm writing up this report and I'm not, you know, making the conclusion not to move forward. And again, first of all, let's decide there is the Justice Department policy, which I think is the correct policy, and which is the constitutional policy of you can't indict a sitting president. So, you know, that said, you know, any indictment would come after his term. But given the tenor of our country, and given that they're going to be, and there are, right, tons of people who have said, well, this was a partisan hack job, they're going to let him off the hook, it's so forth. I think it would be incumbent on the special prosecutor to really spell out the reasons why they're reaching that conclusion, even though those reasons might not be politically helpful or palatable. But when that is sort of the chief, you know, I guess, defense, right? I think it is. I think you need to extrapolate that.
You could say
the language was maybe too colorful or something like that. But I think if it had been so neutral, and it was just something like, well, the president could not recall certain details, I think people would be screaming the fix is in.
Well, no, yeah, I see your point. And I think maybe our disagreement is less than what it might appear to be on the surface, is that I think you can make that case without, maybe I'm just focusing too much on
maybe a little aesthetic, right?
Yes.
It's.
And I am inclined to, maybe more than some on the left, to give her a bit of benefit of the doubt. That's just because, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say, well, her is a Republican partisan hack because he was appointed a U.S. attorney by Donald Trump. And my response to that is, if you think presidents, any, even the most involved in details presidents, know all of the people they are appointing to be U.S. attorneys, you have a very uninformed, I would say, view of the presidency. But Donald Trump, more than most, would not really be informed of those sort of...
He drills down on the details, Mike. He's got...
But also that, when you... I looked back to the comments that were made when Merrick Garland, right, Biden's attorney general, appointed her. And there were all sorts of praise, you know, no-nonsense guy. He's a true professional, fair-minded, a nonpartisan seeker of justice. And so to me, the idea that this guy was established a record like this over a long career, all of a sudden, in the space of little over a year, becomes a partisan hack, I don't buy that. That doesn't really track for me.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I don't think so either. And you're saying, I guess wanted to be clear, you're saying a Republican partisan hack.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think if that were really the case, well, then I suppose he would have come out with a different recommendation at the end.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you can make the case that this is the worst possible scenario.
Yeah, these are the facts. And look, I think he's on the one hand, I think he's absolutely right that no jury would ever convict for a number of reasons. But yeah, I think he's correct there, and that it would probably be by that point not a good use, wise use of government resources to bring charges against a former president, an elderly former president, for documents which at this point have all been returned.
But let's go back to something you said earlier, and I agree with you in saying that the job of the special counsel is essentially fact-finding. And you could make the case that, well, the fact-finding would involve, here are the allegations, here is what we found, to the extent of whether or not those allegations seem to us to be substantiated. And in making arguments about what a jury might or might not do years in the future, that's actually going beyond the purview of the special counsel. And I think that's not an unreasonable case for some to make.
I would agree.
And yet Herb did that.
That said, I mean, it's still, you know, the way it is, it's, you know, I'd have to look at what his specific mandate was, you know, probably find the evidence and make a recommendation.
Should that recommendation be based on the evidence or be based on the special counsel's belief?
I think that's a good question. Yeah. I think that's a completely fair question, yeah. Right? That you could say, listen, I think there's evidence there. Jury could conclude, regardless of what I, you know, I think there's enough, you know, smoke there to, you know, to indict, and a jury can make its own, draw its own conclusions.
Yeah.
And I think that's, this is sort of what I want to get into a little bit. And this isn't even necessarily a political question, because I was thinking about this a fair amount. And the argument that we do, you know, we have this two-tiered system of justice. If your name is Clinton or Biden, you know, you're going to get royal treatment. If your name is Trump, you know, you will not. And look, I think there's something to that, but I also think there's something that it's not entirely just partisan political stuff. And hear me out on this. I think there's almost sort of like a, because I had this too, right? When they first announced special counsel, there's like an impossibility bias, I think is the word I'm looking for, right? And it's sort of like what happened when Trump was first elected, that no one thought Trump could get elected just because, well, that's impossible, right? You just can't do that. And I think there's something like that going on here that I think people are unable to imagine what this would look like, right? You can't imagine Biden actually being prosecuted and before these documents. I think there's something to that, okay, right?
I see what you're saying, and I understand how, from a conservative perspective, one might see it that way. But I don't see it that way. I think that the distinction between Trump and Clinton, Biden, those other folks that you mentioned, is that Trump is just a much more outrageous character who has shown a gleeful willingness to violate the law on multiple occasions. Yeah. And so, of course, it's easier for me to see Trump being prosecuted because I think he's a lot more crooked than these other people, you know?
Right. No, but that's my point. And again, it's not a political point, or I think it is a political point, but it's not a partisan type point. It's more a political point in the bigger, I don't know, almost like a sovereign immunity type thing. And again, maybe I'm wading in too deep, because this isn't anything anyone else is talking about, and it is just kind of my own little pet weirdness, right? But it is almost sort of a thing of, well, you know, you can't sue the king, or you can't, you know, do this. And you would say that Biden, Clinton, et cetera, are the establishment. They're the king. Trump has always been an outsider, right? And thus, when you say, and properly so, because he does outrageous things. That's what I mean. You could say, yeah, can you see this guy getting hauled before a jury, even if he's president, and getting, you know, prosecuted? Well, yeah, you can. But I think it's more
difficult. I understand what you're saying, but
even for me, right? It's more difficult to
see what you're saying
happening.
I get what you're saying, but I disagree. I think it would be just as difficult for me to see, say, George W. Bush or Mitt Romney being hauled before a jury on the same things compared to.
Yes, no, exactly. No, but that's exactly the same point. Yes.
But Trump is different, and Trump is different not because there's some unfair bias against him, but Trump is different because he's a bad guy. He's a bad guy who doesn't care about the law, who is just a horrifically bad individual. And so, yeah, it's easier for me to see bad people being punished for that. I think that's a good thing, actually. So,
Well, I think you're right. But I think the Bush, although there was certainly talk of, you know, George Bush should be prosecuted for war crimes.
Sure, there's talk, but yeah, that's just.
But no one actually. There was no actual prosecutor who would, you know. Again, there was no special counsel who would take the case. But I think that falls into the same sort of thing. If it's not partisan, right? It's not Democrat or Republican necessarily. It's establishment versus non-establishment.
And see, that's where I disagree. I see what you're saying. I think Trump could be.
And you think it's just because Trump's a crook?
Yeah, exactly. Though I will say that perhaps some of the non-establishment thing does come in, because in general, I think it's easier to go push against someone who is not like us. So I think.
Right. And most crooks are not establishment.
No, that's probably, yeah, true.
Well, no, I think I could make a compelling argument that Hillary Clinton's a crook, but she's still part of the establishment.
Yeah, absolutely. But I would say she's a lot less crooked. Yeah. But anyway, so.
That was just a weird detour of mine.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll pull out of that cul-de-sac for a minute. But, I think also the larger political question is clear here, right? Which is why this is such a horrible outcome for Joe Biden. And I think that there was a point that was raised on our Discord I forget who it was. It might have been Daniel, someone, if you know who you are, but making the point that, well, how concerned should we be about forgetting names and mixing things up? Like, for instance, not too long ago, in fact, last Sunday, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson went on Meet the Press and said, we passed support for Iran many months ago, mixing up Iran and Israel. You can listen to Donald Trump. Donald Trump, when he was actually talking about Biden being cognitively impaired and about how that's so dangerous, he said, under Biden, we would be in for World War II. He mixed up Nikki Haley and Nancy.
Although they're actually I could read that as like a really funny subtle joke, but
yeah, that's not.
I don't think Trump meant it that way. But
and
that's
he certainly didn't mean to mix up Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi. Right. There have been speeches where he slurred his words. He's mixed up Obama and Biden. And so what I'm saying is that
he sort of mixed up a couple years back when doing an endorsement, sort of did a portmanteau of like a couple different Ohio Senate candidates.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the point is that when we think about this, and I think it's important to think about, it's like, well, certainly with age, people forget words, terms, and some people are more prone to that than others. Joe Biden's been prone to that for a long time, issues with public speaking. But to what extent is that an indicator of a deeper cognitive deficit? Because I think there are plenty of folks who have just poor recall in general, who are really sharp and can be good critical thinkers. And that's the sort of thing that matters in a president, not if they can immediately, you know, say, well, this person's the president of Mexico or something like that. Yeah. And I think that's an important argument, but that's much more difficult thing to evaluate, certainly with the very limited evidence that we get. And that's, in fact, the argument that Biden's team is making is like, listen, he's really sharp. He follows policy arguments. He's his own man. It's not like he's some doddering old fool who can't understand things and make good decisions. And that's not an unreasonable argument. It's just difficult to demonstrate, right?
Well, a couple of things. I'm thinking back to the Saturday Night Live skit after the first Bush-Gore debate, right? When they had the Will Ferrell then as Bush listing off all the names of, like, you know, African deputy
right
secretaries of agriculture, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. But I'm terrible with names, and I do it, and it's embarrassing, and I do blank occasionally. And anybody who talks a lot for a living or even as a hobby, kind of like we do, or you do it right, the more apt that you're going to trip at some point. And I've certainly done that plenty of times on the show, certainly done it plenty of times in my real life in practice. Trey always calls me Ken.
I try to correct him,
but he just keeps going. So look, I'll say, yeah, I'm sensitive to that. And I get that. And there are those verbal flubs that people make because they're human. That said, to say that there's no other evidence, if it was just verbal flubs here and there in isolation, it would be just kind of like a funny, you know, Saturday Night Live joke kind of thing, right?
I agree with you here. And I got to say that I mentioned you before we went on that we actually started a little late because I wanted to dig a little deeper. And so I watched a chunk of Donald Trump's speech at the NRA convention just, I think it was yesterday, a couple of days ago. Then I compared it to Joe Biden's speech, not that speech he gave in response to the special counsel thing, but to make more of an apples to apples comparison, the speech he gave at the Las Vegas rally before the Nevada primaries, which was fairly recent. And what I noticed is that the going from the introductory speakers to the main event, the energy level, the focus, the excitement went down so much for Biden. And it was just the opposite for Trump. I mean, I disagree with almost everything Trump said. It was like in 30 seconds, he told 8 lies, you know, but my God, right. he looked energized and focused and on top of things. Whereas Joe Biden just, it was really, I felt bad. And that's the sort of thing, even if there isn't necessarily any sort of serious cognitive deficit, when I look at that, I think, oh my God, what are the debates going to look like? And how is this person going to make a case that the American people find convincing? And wow, it really took me back, because to this point, I hadn't watched a lot of their recent debate, or not debate, rally type stuff. And wow, the distinction, the difference is just really huge.
Yeah. So that was going to be my point. There's a lot of evidence. It's not just forgetting names or slipping up and saying Mexico instead of Egypt here and there. It's a consistent pattern over quite a number of years. And there's a lot of other evidence that, you know, I mean, get the look, you know, you look in the eyes and it looks like nobody's home. Right. I mean, I think that's the best way to describe it. And I'm not saying I'm some sort of cognitive psychologist. I can diagnose him or anything like that. But people have their common experiences of people they deal with every day in their lives. And, you know,
and that's fair.
You know, sometimes grandma just doesn't got it anymore. Right. I mean.
No, when I was watching Biden's response to the special counsel report, I noticed, and I think everyone who watched it kind of closely noticed, that when after the scripted part of it was over, in listening to and responding to reporter questions, there was that sense of him being sort of lost and having to strain a lot more, and that bothers me certainly. And not only that, but added to that, the fact that for the second year in a row, he declined the pre-Super Bowl interview. And that would be a fairly friendly, low-key type of thing, most likely not that long. And that to me goes against this idea that, well, it's just that he's not quite as sharp about remembering names and things like that. I mean, if Joe Biden's really mentally sharp, he shouldn't. You know, he should do something like say, OK, I'm going to do the Super Bowl interview, or even something kind of more out there saying like, you know what, I'm going to take the Montreal cognitive assessment. Right. It's one of these cognitive tests, takes like 30 to 15 minutes, something like that. Even challenge Donald Trump. Say, listen, you think I'm slow. Hey, let's you know, that's obviously too big of a political risk. And I think neither of those guys would do too well on that, which is why it's not a great idea to have people
Trump
this
would do
age,
very, very
I
well.
Think.
Trump would do the best ever. Trump would get the highest score that has ever been recorded.
But again,
I can tell you.
The idea, I don't think anyone believes that Joe Biden is the most qualified person in this country to be president of the United States. That to me is just ludicrous. That said, I think I go back to something Ken said on the show, I don't know, a long time ago. I think it was in regards to Fetterman, saying that, you know what the important thing really is the policy choices, right? And that even if, I think in regards to Fetterman, he's saying, even if Fetterman was essentially incapacitated, that he was a better choice than Oz because the policies that would be enacted under his watch would be better policies than you would get from his opponent. And so that would be that, and even if those policies would be enacted by staffers, essentially, it's still a better deal. And in the end, those people would be accountable because you're accountable to the results. And so it all kind of works out in the wash, essentially. And that's not I think there's something to that argument, actually.
And I don't entirely disagree with seeing it that way, but I think you can make a distinction between Fetterman, who's one vote out of 100, and the other guy who is the chief executive, right?
Oh, yeah. Fully.
In some ways, Fetterman's job is to, you know, it's you know, yay or nay, you know, those or present, perhaps. Those are your, you know what I mean? Those are your choices. And as long as you get that right, you're good enough. Like I can relate an experience when I worked in the Ohio House. We had several members who were, I'm no secret, cognitively disabled. And my job was literally to walk with them to committee and make sure they sat down next to the person they're supposed to sit down next to. And that they're not interdicted by someone else along the way who might give them, hey, here's another suggestion. You know, the thing was, you know, go, you sit next to this guy, watch what he does, vote like he does. So, but again, that's a situation where you're talking about a legislative body and one vote out of however many. It's different when you're talking about someone who has so much discretionary authority. You know, again, John Fetterman, you know, doesn't carry the nuclear codes.
I guess I would say my bottom line on all of this is that I don't think Joe Biden ever intended to step aside after his first 4 years. It was something he said to get help himself, you know, to help get elected. And he may truly believe that he is more than up for the job for another 4+ years. I don't share that belief. And I think that the right thing for him to have done would have been to have announced that he was going to step aside a year or so ago to be able to pave the way for someone like a Gretchen Whitmer, kind of a younger person who would be that next generation. And he chose not to do that. But we see that in all phases of life where you hang on to that position, deluding yourself into that. And I think that certainly it makes it far more likely that Donald Trump will get elected. Now, in the end, when that is our choice, I am going to support Joe Biden, because I think even a Joe Biden at 50% of capacity is better for the country than Donald Trump. But God knows Donald Trump at full speed is scary as hell for me. But very disappointed that Joe Biden made the decision he did to stick with it, even though I certainly understand that decision.
So let me just throw out, and this is just the political strategy question. Given that Biden has done things like he's not going to do the Super Bowl, pre-Super Bowl interview, his message on like the Macy's Day Parade, I mean, those have been just like painful. But that he would avoid those type of like you said, would be sort of softball type interviews and softball type forums. But then someone convinces him that it's a good idea to go out that same night and have a press conference and take questions. I mean, that's, to me, that's political malpractice of the highest order. And it's just kind of baffling. You know, who thought that that was going to go well?
Well, maybe he did. I mean, we don't know that. We don't know the
answer. And that could be. And that could be. He could say, look, I'm going to go out there. But at that point, you know, you would think you would have plenty of people around you to say, well, Mr. President, you know, yeah, maybe not tonight. Right.
Yeah. Well, and certainly going out there and reading off a teleprompter was not the way to do it. I think the way to do it would have been to come out with a very energetic, short, clearly unscripted sort of thing, so that people could point to that and say, okay, yeah, it wasn't that long, but boy, he sure seemed fired up and with it and on top of his game. He didn't do that. And I think that was, I don't think it made things better. That's for sure.
And all the responses to some of the questions came really close to, you know, hey, kids, get the hell off my lawn. I mean, it really got that, you really got that kind of vibe from it, which I think was not what he was going for, but.
I think if ever there was a time for a constitutional amendment about the age, about age of presidential candidates, this would be that time. All right. Well, why don't we move on from that, moving from Biden to Trump, right? There was a very important.
Yeah, well, I'll lead off on this. Yeah. because that's my job. And oral arguments. Yeah. Speaking of people who are don't seem to be cognitively disabled, there were oral arguments in Trump versus Anderson last week. This, of course, is the Colorado case where Colorado Secretary of State has essentially removed Trump from the ballot based on the 14th Amendment's insurrection clause. The justices across the board seemed pretty skeptical of Colorado's claims, focusing, as we did, Mike, and they, so, you know, they listen and, you know, they take into account what we say, the procedural defects, right? And not getting into whether, you know, what's an insurrection, what's not an insurrection, or did Trump commit one, but whether he's an officer of the United States that is subject to that provision of the 14th Amendment. This, I mean, there were significant questions from Ketanji Brown Jackson, pointing out that, listen, Congress put this list in here. They list specific offices. They discussed listing president. They chose not to. I think it was Kagan who probably said earlier, we are all textualists now. And Kagan also chimed in that, listen, if there's any ambiguity here, shouldn't that ambiguity be construed in favor of democracy? Justice Roberts, for his part, asked an interesting question about, well, what, you know, isn't there a concern that you could have red states, so to speak, seek to invalidate a president on, you know, for whatever conduct, you know, if you simply call it insurrection, which was a point I made. So again, great minds. But my sense, you know, throughout this, and I think most observers, was that it was not a good day for the state of Colorado and the 14th Amendment argument. And it could be an 8-1 or even 9-0 decision.
Yeah.
So your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, I agree. I agree on all of that. I think the only justice who might conceivably go the other way is Sotomayor. I mean, at one point she said, she mentioned there's a lot of examples of states relying on Section 3 to disqualify insurrectionists, but she's specifically said for state offices. So I think this is a unanimous.
And Clarence Thomas got through that too. And then some questioning with the counsel for Colorado that all the examples were states making determinations about state officers, which is a completely different question than what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So I think this is a unanimous decision, especially after the oral argument. And there was one other thing I wanted to point out, an argument that I hadn't thought about that we hadn't discussed previously. But one of the arguments from Trump's attorney was that because the 14th Amendment gives Congress the ability to lift that disqualification by a 2/3 vote.
Oh, yeah. I was going to mention that.
Yeah, yes. That's a great argument because the argument is basically that, well, if a state can't preemptively ban a candidate from the ballot, because then if Congress later lifts that disqualification, that takes away the rights of millions of people to, in effect, choose that candidate. And I thought that was a really strong argument, one that hadn't occurred to me. So,
that goes into what was one of Kagan's most probing questions. We're here today to decide if one state can decide, who gets to be the president. The one other thing I would mention, something, a statement from the Colorado's counsel that was a little chilling, perhaps, was the idea that he floated that, well, Congress could still find Trump to be not qualified. And again, you're sort of, you know, well, wait a second, isn't that sort of what we're wading into as far as the, you know, insurrectionist type theories? That troubled me a little bit because there very much could be a scenario, right, where I think most people expect that Democrats will take control of the House. The House is seated January 1st, 2nd, whatever, and the president is inaugurated January 20th. So you could have a House of Representatives rejecting the president, sort of a la exactly what Trump wanted Mike Pence to do. And if there could be calls, well, if the House just does what it's supposed to, Biden's president, right?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That's an interesting, because there's that period, right, where the new chambers, the Senate, though, would probably be a Republican Senate at that point. But there, the possibility exists for, something like that, which would not be good. There was one.
But again, if I'm the guy arguing this before the Supreme Court, I'm not going to say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, right. Well, I think you know, I almost felt a certain amount of sympathy.
And again, I'm looking, in fairness, hey, you're in front of the Supreme Court and you know, the pressure's on and, you know, who knows what comes out, but still.
Yeah. Certainly.
Don't say the I word.
Certainly plenty of Trump's attorneys before the Supreme Court have said, put out some arguments that are just like, what? I don't think we're willing to go there. But there was one other thing I wanted to bring up. It's actually a question from Atoms. He's one of our supporters on Discord. And Atoms wrote, I think most people assume that the Supreme Court is going to rule that Trump's name can be on the ballot. But if the Supreme Court wants Biden to lose, wouldn't it be better for them to rule against him? Because this would presumably allow Nikki Haley to become the nominee, who is widely regarded as being capable of beating Biden. So I think that's an interesting question, because if you start from the premise that the Supreme Court is a partisan hack sort of dominated branch of government or institution, well, then you could argue that that might actually be the better strategic choice. So maybe this demonstrates the court's lack of partisanship on this. I don't know.
Well, I saw that and I don't buy it. Again, I don't buy the premise. Can the court do things that are political, ideological, partisan at times? I hate to say it, but yes. But that said, I think I think the court tends to first view itself in terms of institutionalist relationships, right? You know, between the three branches, as opposed to who's president, who's not president. And I think justices, this is how the framers intended it, right? When you have life terms, take the long view and would be reluctant, even if they were so inclined, right? Even if a justice was the worst partisan hack ever, to take steps that could, undermine the court's legitimacy long term in order to get one person elected president over another.
Yeah, I think I generally agree with that for sure.
I didn't state that quite as well as I would have liked.
But yeah,
I just don't buy into the premise that the court is sitting there picking who would we like. And also, again, it's a little bit of that complicated plans usually fail.
Yes.
And that's sort of a complicated plan. You know what I mean? There's, you could say, well, okay, Trump's off the ballot here, but there's a whole lot of things that would have to happen between then and now and then, for Nikki Haley to get the nomination.
Yes.
So I think the court wouldn't be that, you know.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, all right. Why don't we move on to another Trump court case? There's no shortage of Donald Trump in the courts, right, Jay?
Yeah, the court giveth and the court taketh away.
That's right. That's right.
The other case we're talking about, of course, is the D.C. Circuit's decision on whether President Trump is immune from prosecution. They determined that he is not. This is arising out of the January 6th insurrection claims. So the court essentially said that, well, there's a 57 page opinion. I won't go through the entire thing, but the gist is that there's not a separation of powers issue here. One of the things Trump had argued, if we want to get in the legal weeds, was, well, it's kind of like the debate clause, which applies to Congress. And I think the response to that, which was, of course, is, well, yeah, but you're not in Congress. And again, the sort of the sovereign immunity, presidential privilege, again, it doesn't seem to apply there. And the court sort of makes the claim, or makes the argument, makes the case, let's put it that way, that presidents, we've determined, are subject to civil liability, and that there's no real clear principle why they couldn't be, after they're out of office, subject to criminal liability as well. And there's no sweeping privilege. So Trump, of course, is going to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court. The other thing that was actually sort of fun, if you're into the weed stuff about this, is something that the court did in terms of staying the issuance of its mandate.
Yes. Yes. I was hoping you get into this.
Yeah. So what they did, now, the way this works, right, you go to the Court of Appeals and you make your arguments and they come up with a decision, And there's a decision, which is sort of the opinion written out saying, here's all the reasons that you win or you lose. And then there's an order that says, you know, hereby, you know, consistent with our opinion, you win or you lose. And then there's this other step, which is the mandate, is what makes it sort of really official. At which point the court says, and we're either one dismissing the case or sending it back to the trial court. So the Court of Appeals has really sort of complete discretion on when it issues the mandate. It usually does so, you know, it's usually a week or so after the decision, because usually there's no issue about why would you wait or not wait. But in this case, they said, listen, we're going to stay issuing the mandate and give you, I think it's 30 days, or was it even 20 days, maybe less than that, to file an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, Trump would have 90 days to file with the Supreme Court anyway. What Court of Appeals is doing is sort of setting it up so that, listen, if you want to get to the Supreme Court fast, we will stay essentially going forward to the trial, you know, with this. If you want to drag it out, then you're not going to get the benefit of that stay, and you know the proceedings below will keep going while you appeal. I probably didn't explain.
Although
that
actually,
very well.
Though, yeah,
I thought,
no, no,
I thought that was fascinating.
The larger point, though, actually, it's an even shorter timeline that the court only gave him until Monday to file to file an appeal with the Supreme Court, and so that's talk about a time frame. I mean, that's basically just saying, hey, you need to just no 30 days, but literally you have the weekend to think this over, essentially. And I think in part because it's understood by a lot of folks that one of the motives here, I think that it was a long shot argument at best, right? Because as the court pointed out, they wrote, at bottom, former President Trump's stance would collapse our system of separated powers by placing the president beyond the reach of all three branches. And that's not good. No, I mean, that's not no one wants that. Well, almost no one wants that. And so it was, I think, clearly a delaying tactic, and the court's just not having any of it for that reason. And because, I mean, Judge Chutkan originally scheduled the trial to start on March 4th. Last week, she issued an order basically scrapping that day, but she's been really clear on wanting to move forward with the trial fairly expeditiously. And she said, in fact, that she was going to issue a new start date as soon as the immunity claim is resolved. And this is really unless the Supreme Court decides to kind of takes the case and slow walks this, which I don't think they're going to do at all, then this case is going to go forward in the district court pretty quickly. And that means that even with all the delaying tactics that I'm sure Trump's attorneys will attempt to use, we're still almost certainly going to get to some sort of a verdict before people are voting in the general election. And that's what Trump wanted to avoid, because, of course, all the polling suggests that one of the most dangerous things for Donald Trump electorally is if he is, in fact, convicted of any sort of serious offense. And this, of course, there's a conviction here that would be a conviction of a serious offense.
So there's the other view of this. It was an editorial, Wall Street Journal, which usually follows my thinking. And Mike, it's always heartening that you and I'll say something to you on Saturday, and it's in the Wall Street Journal editorial page on Monday, and I'm like, yeah, they listened. The Journal makes a point that the breadth of the D.C. Circuit ruling, that they could have written it more narrowly, raises concerns that we could end up in a banana republic type situation where every former president, as soon as you leave office, is subject to indictment, trial. I think that's the way the Spartans used to do it, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I heard that argument.
It was sort of like as soon as you were done being sort of the dictator of Sparta, which you were term limited, then you would be put on trial for your crimes and either convicted or not. But those guys were pretty hardcore. But Trump himself has said, you know, look, if he's reelected, it's, you know, ripe to indict Joe Biden and so forth. And I think that sets a troubling precedent in terms of look, I'm going to exact, you know, political revenge by finding something to prosecute someone over. And I would hope that when this goes to the Supreme Court, which it will, and they will take it, there's some narrowing, right?
See, I would hope the court
it's tied real specifically to the facts here that, you know, in this case, this is why there's no immunity.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with that in the way you do. I mean, Trump's attorney made that argument, of course. In fact, he said, if immunity is not granted to a president, every future president who leaves office will be immediately indicted by the opposing party. Without complete immunity, a president of the United States would not be able to properly function. And I thought, well, yes, that's kind of what happens if you're in Donald Trump's headspace. Certainly Donald Trump, a lawless man, would have no problem perverting justice to do that. But I don't think Joe Biden is a lawless man. I don't think Merrick Garland is a lawless man. I don't even think an attorney general like under former President Trump, Bill Barr, was a lawless man. So I think this is a Trump problem. And so that's why I reject it. If we insist on electing lawless men to be president of the United States, yes, you're going to have this problem. There's an easier fix. Don't elect clear crooks to the job just because you happen to like their rallies. That would be a better approach. So I don't have any problem with what the D.C. Circuit said. I would, in fact, hope that the Supreme Court just doesn't take up the case and let's just move on as quickly as possible.
I suppose. Again, I would make the argument, and we've talked about this before, you know, Biden reportedly, as the New York Times said, saying, I want Trump prosecuted.
But that's a different. I know you've talked about this before, but I think it's one thing to say when there is somebody who seems to have almost clearly, willfully and gleefully violated the law, saying, yeah. Well, yeah, I think probably that guy should be prosecuted, as opposed to saying like, well, you know, this person's my political enemy, so let's just find something to prosecute him. And I think you would agree.
Well, like say he willfully stored and disclosed top secret stuff and stored it next to the Camaro. Right.
And the attorney general appointed a fair-minded, no-nonsense person affiliated with the opposite political party to investigate this and make a recommendation. So that's, I mean,
right. That's not race judicata. That's not a bar to Trump takes office and puts in another prosecutor who sees things differently.
Well, sure. And that's a Donald Trump problem again. The fundamental problem.
But my point is, though, you understand, to some extent, Donald Trump is sui generis. But there's also, I think, the argument, which the Cato and me would make, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it doesn't matter. Donald Trump may be particularly bad, but that's not to say that others haven't been and won't be. So is Nixon, right? I think you can make the argument that Clinton used the federal government to harass his enemies. Johnson, I think, certainly did. Right? I mean,
but
I understand Trump is the extreme case, but I think there's a human nature piece of this that we shouldn't ignore either. And yeah, again, Trump might be the most extreme manifestation of that human nature, but.
Yeah, we shall see. Your prediction is that the Supreme Court will take the case and move expeditiously in deciding. So like within weeks as opposed to months?
I would say probably months, just because that's pretty expeditious for the Supreme Court.
See, I think that's highly problematic. I think if it's months, then that presents a real issue. And I think the court would be doing the nation a disservice by taking months on what is a fairly straightforward and not at all complex technical legal issue that has already had, you know, been adjudicated.
Right. It's all been briefed and argued. Yeah, I get that.
And months means that there's the potential that there could not be a decision about whether or not a presidential candidate is a convicted felon before people have the opportunity to vote. And that would be a great disservice to the country. So if the Supreme Court takes months on this, I would be a lot more inclined.
You would see a conspiracy theory.
Well, not see a conspiracy, but I would say that the Supreme Court would be failing in its duty and would be failing the country in a pretty significant way.
I'll split the difference in like 6 weeks. No, again, my thing is, I'm just there's a certain amount of time, no matter how long, quickly you're moving, that these things just take.
I think the best thing the court could do, and it's well within the court's rights, is just to say we're denying.
Right.
We're
or denying oral arguments next. Or okay. Well, I was going to say oral arguments next Tuesday, but
yeah. But I think the simplest thing to do is just to deny cert and just move on. And then, boom, that's the quickest possible thing. And I would like to see him do that. So do nothing.
Yeah. See, I'm troubled by that because I do think this is for a case of this importance that you ought to have the Supreme Court weigh in on it and not just do it in a, again, because cert denial, right? There's never for our listeners who don't follow all this stuff along at home. There's no opinion, right? Typically, sometimes every once in a while there's a dissent, but it's just a two word cert denied, and that's it. And all you know is that there were not four justices; there were at least five who didn't see it worth taking. I shouldn't say at least five. There were not four who would see it as worth taking.
Right, because you technically, sure.
Because you could have some people who aren't in the discussions for one reason or another, but
yeah. So I guess, well, like I said, we'll see what happens. What I hope the court does is, again, not because I feel like this is a largely frivolous claim that would be a waste of the court's time, and also gives the court the opportunity to not get itself embroiled in this. They could just say, well, let's just let the DC Circuit take the heat for this, and we're just going to move on. But
yeah, so I think our difference here is just on the timeline of what you think is expeditious and what I think is expeditious.
Yeah. And I am looking at is the political timeline and saying that it is critical, I would argue, for the democracy, for voters to have a sense of, well, to know whether or not their candidate is a convicted felon before they make their choice in an election, ideally before they make their choice, even in a presidential primary, but that ship has sailed largely. So at least certainly before, sometime in late summer, right? Because at that point,
I put less salience on the answer to that question to the average voter. Just because I think people have made up, whatever a jury says, people have made up their mind about Donald Trump, if he's a crook, not a crook.
Except the polling
suggests, if he's a crook and they'll still vote for him.
Except the polling says something very, very different. I mean, the polling says that Trump's numbers just drop significantly if he's convicted of something. So now certainly that
but I
that
think
won't,
the polling's wrong.
Well, certainly that won't affect the MAGA types, right?
Right.
Trump's base, but it will absolutely have an effect on the potentially somewhat undecided wavering type folks. So I think you're wrong about the polling being wrong, and we're kind of at an impasse at that point.
Right. We'll see when it happens.
Well, hopefully it will happen, but at least I won't say hopefully it will happen because I don't want to prejudge Donald Trump, even though I have my suspicions about
him. You would rather have Trump be elected than have me be right.
Yeah, God, no, it's certainly not that. All right. Well, on that note, I kind of thought this would happen. We presidential politics type stuff and legal issues have taken up all of our time, but we have so many other things that we want to get into, and we're going to get into those things in the midweek supporters show. We want to talk about the immigration bill that wasn't, the Ukraine and Israel aid bills that maybe stand some kind of a chance, but I don't know. Speaking of immigration, Secretary Mayorkas escaping impeachment narrowly. We didn't even mention Nevada primaries and caucuses. So we have a lot of things we're going to get to in that midweek supporter show. And if you're a supporter, of course, you'll be getting that. Also, as a supporter, you get ad-free versions of everything we release. The full-length midweek episode, as opposed to just that preview, access to the Politics Guys Discord, which is, wow, it, the last few weeks has just really blown up, incredibly lively, some great stuff going on there. So to check it all out, you can go to politicsguys.com/support, or you can go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And as always, the support links for everything are there in our show notes. And if you'd like to get the full-length midweek episode, but you're not in a position to financially support us, just send me an email. I'm mike@politicsguys.com. I will be happy to get that set up for you. And whether you're a supporter or not a supporter, it really helps us out if you can subscribe to the podcast, rate and review us on whatever app you're using, as well as pass along information about the episodes on about the show on social media. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, you can do that through email. We're mail@politicsguys.com. There's that Discord channel I already mentioned, as well as Facebook and X, and you'll find links to all of that in the show notes. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our fantastic executive producers of the show, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.